I don't think people give themselves enough credit or push themselves enough. I don't think they even know where the limit is. Mm. You know, I use this phrase all the time. You never know where the line is until you cross it a little.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome back to Think Big Bodybuilding Media. Advice is radio if you are listening on audio. I'm Scott McNally, and today we've got the great opportunity to talk to a bodybuilder I've looked up to for a long time, IFBB Pro John Meadows. Today we're going to talk to John about all things training, and I figured that if we were going to talk to John about training, we better bring along Dr. Scott Stevenson, because Dr. Scott and John have been friends since forever now, I'm pretty sure. They've seen a lot of crazy sets go down in the gym together. Plus, Dr. Scott is the co-author for John's book, The Brutality of Mountain Dog Training. So I figured he would be great for helping us to weed out some more of John's thoughts. So we are going to talk about the Mountain Dog system and how he came up with that, how it's evolved over time. We are going to talk about intuitive training and so much more. There's a bunch of good stuff in this. I know you guys are going to enjoy it. So sit back, relax, and do me a favor. Leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. If you haven't hit the subscribe button yet, please do, and click the notification bell so you can stay up to date with everything we have coming out. This program is brought to you by True Nutrition. Our code is ADVICES. We got that down in the show notes if you guys want to shop with them and get some high quality supplements. All right, guys, let's get to John Meadows and Dr. Scott. Hey guys, welcome back to Think Big Bodybuilding Media and Advices Radio. If you're new to the channel here and you're watching this on YouTube, please hit the subscribe button. And if you enjoy this show, then definitely smash the like as well. Today, Dr. Scott Stevenson and I are with the one and only, the Mountain Dog himself, John Meadows. What's up, man? How you been?
Good, good. What are y'all up to?
We've been up to all sorts of stuff, Scott. You just got back from, where were you? Just Scotland? So you've been traveling.
Yeah,
we've been knocking out.
I was gonna brag about being outside in the sunshine today. Literally, it's probably like 75 degrees, and I know it's not like that in Columbus.
Yeah,
but I'm getting ready to be up there eventually, you know. And so I'm preparing with heaters and stuff for the cold around the Arnold Classic. So, yeah, it's how cold is it right there now, John?
It's not bad. It's like 30s, maybe 38, 39. It's not bad.
And you still have shorts on, I presume.
No, I had to cover every winter. When it gets cold, I cover up my calves and I don't train them a whole lot. And then when spring comes, I start hitting them every day and I get them jacked up again. And then I put my shorts back on.
I'm sure they shrink by maybe a millimeter or two, right?
They don't like my calves. Like people, oh, that's just genetics. No, when I don't train them, man, they shrink.
Really?
Yeah, they shrink a lot. I get so annoyed when people just, oh man, your calves are just genetics. Like, no, they're not. I got to train them every day to get them like that.
That's funny. And that's
the, you train them every day, literally until your feet are sore. That used to be the rule of thumb. I think you
start. You're kidding.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I would do them every day, and I would take a day off when my feet started to get sore. I'd think, okay, that's probably enough. I probably need to back off.
We always get so many different people with their idea on what calves are supposed to be, the way that we should train them. I'm not a big guy, but calves are like the one thing I have not had to work for at all. I've heard so many. Now I heard Palumbo, for instance, he said, you got to go heavy and just get right into the heavy stuff. Do 3-4 heavy sets, do that 3 times a week and get out. Obviously you're hitting them more than that, John, but what would be to start us out here today? What's your calf advice to people? What works for you?
Well, I've never heard Dave say that, but it's actually very, very close to what I would say. I think you've got to really emphasize the stretch at the bottom. I've always felt like, you know, you walk around and you're always in some degree of plantar flexion, but you're never really in a hard stretch position. So I always emphasize that. And I do like to use real heavy loads and put a heavy stretch on them. And I do keep the volume way, way down, way, way down. So I would pretty much say the same thing as Dave, except I would do probably more, a little bit more, a day or two more. I would work on the stretch. And then I also like to work in the tibialis anterior stuff so that your lower leg is completely low to full blood. So, you know, some kind of toe raise or something like that.
So tibialis, now that's like the front?
Yes.
Okay. So that's, Scott, I don't think anybody really does work for the tibialis that I'm aware of. Like, that's not a common thing. I've never heard somebody say like, hey, I'm going to work on my tibialis today, you know?
I mean, I my perspective is a little bit blurred because I know John's been doing that, and I started doing those really actually as a part of a pump set in fortitude training. So when I train legs,
yeah,
sometimes when I do when I get to the calves, I do like a calf press, like you're like on a leg press maybe. Sometimes the machine, the selectorized machine leg presses will let you do this. Which is what I'm thinking of at one of the gyms here, and you do calf presses. And then put your feet up top, so just your heels are on the plate.
Yeah.
And you do basically a tibialis anterior reverse toe raise, so to speak.
Huh, no kidding.
So you're pulling your feet up and basically doing the leg press in that manner.
Huh.
And so those burn like crazy. If you haven't, you got to be careful, though. If you haven't done them, which most people haven't, you'll get really sore really quickly. That muscle is relatively untrained for most people. Yep. So.
Now, can you explain that, John? What's the benefit of training the tibialis when it comes to calf growth?
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think there's a benefit to training bis when you train tris and vice versa?
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think the benefit is?
I feel like you're getting, well, let's see, you're getting more blood flow in. They're opposite muscles. I don't know though. I'm just thinking in the gym. If I train both biceps and triceps in the same day, I'm going to get one hell of a pump in my arm. That's for sure.
Yeah, you just answered your question.
Okay.
You get a lot of blood down there, and I think it's very effective.
I like that.
It's a metabolic stress thing. The way I think about it, there's literally I think it's a sural artery. You don't have very good blood flow in your calves.
Hmm.
So literally, it's not tremendous. A lot of it is dependent upon the muscle pump. Like the people get varicose veins because those valves give out and you don't get the blood flow coming back as it should. So if you're hit the plantar flexors and then the dorsiflexors, like one after the other, like everything is just full. If you go back and forth,
yeah,
do a couple of those back and forth, you're talking like your lower leg will be engorged in a way that most people never have experienced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very, very effective.
So the thing we wanted to bring John on today for was to talk training. You know, we've had the chance to talk with John a few times now. Last time was before you guys were getting ready to do a seminar in Columbus. That was not this last year, but the year before. Is that something, by the way, are you guys considering doing something like that again this year for the Arnold Classic, John?
No, I don't have any plans on it this time.
Okay. Okay. Anything that you have going on? Anybody that you're working with? Out of curiosity, before we get into the training stuff, that will be competing there.
Well, Terrence Ruffin, and you know, he sent me his check-in today, and he looks amazing. He looks insane. He looks like he did maybe 2 weeks out of his last show.
Oh, no kidding.
He looks amazing, man. He will do damage. And then I'm working on training, but not diet, with Missy Truscott. Do you know Missy? She's a fitness competitor.
Oh, yeah, okay.
She got second in the Olympia. Great shot at winning the Arnold. But the Tuttles, Alexi does her diet, and I help her with her training. She's doing really well.
Nice. That's cool. Yeah, we've had we had Terrence on right before the Niagara show. We had him on just a few days before that. So congratulations on the work you guys did, you know, to get him into that one. I'll look forward to seeing how he looks at the Arnold. But to the topic training, you know, John, I've been following your training for a long time, man. Like, I've been following it since it was just posts on a message board. And I tried to piece it together myself, looking at your principles and trying to develop my own programs just from reading your ideas. And it's interesting because it's evolved. What we know as mountain dog training has evolved so much over the past decade. You know, I'd like to talk about that evolution, but in order to do that, I'd like to kind of just start foundationally. You know, how would you describe mountain dog training? If we had to break it down, what would be some common principles within the programs?
Well, I would say this, first of all, the entire system is based on a lot of mistakes that I've made personally. I mean, that's really what got me to think a lot more about training. I've always been pretty obsessed with training, but I've also made many, many mistakes. And if I were to just give you some basic principles, maybe 8 or 9 principles. So one of them would be never underestimate the importance of mind-muscle connection. I know a lot of people like to laugh at it and, well, just grab a weight and do it. But I do believe firmly that mind-muscle connection is a very big deal. And the better that you can get at it, the more productive every set that you do can be. So what I like for people to start with is an exercise that they tend to feel the best, something that they can really, really feel and get the target muscles working. Obviously, that's not a real good approach for powerlifting, but for bodybuilding, I think it's a good approach.
Yeah.
Once, you know, the blood's flowing, you're feeling good, your workout's off to a good start, then I like to incorporate a lot of the more basic movements, the compound movements that are, you know, a little harder on connective tissue, where, you know, you can just push some weight. I have a very specific way I like to do that, which has changed over the years from mistakes I've made. And it's more of, you know, we like to work up to a set. Typically, it's just one set to, I don't want to say failure, to near failure. I feel like when you got these loads or 85, 87%, something like that, or your one rep maximum, as long as you get close to failure. And I just don't like for people, I don't like for their form to go bad when they're doing a compound movement.
Okay.
It's partially for longevity reasons. I don't like for people to get injured. And also, I just don't think training with bad form is productive. So I'm very, very much a stickler with form. And when you look at those exercises, you know, things like a squat and a bench press, I don't want to see, or a deadlift, I don't want to see people hurting themselves. So I'm very adamant about your form has to be impeccable. All right. So, you know, you move some weight. Ideally, you get a little bit stronger as you go. And then the next exercise I pick is typically something that, you know, Scott mentioned, metabolic stress. It's going to be something more along those lines. It's going to be something where you work up to a set where you might do a cluster set. You might do a set like Scott puts in his programs. And maybe you do partials. Maybe you do who knows. But it's some kind of high-intensity technique that where you can really, really push hard. And, you know, it's almost at some points it almost just becomes kind of a pain tolerance test. But those are the sets that I think make a big difference. And, you know, a lot of people tend to think drop sets are worthless, partials don't do any good and all this stuff. But I would disagree. I would say if they're programmed correctly, they're very, very effective. And then so now you've got your muscle loaded full of blood. It's loaded full of blood. You got that great pump. There's no better feeling in the world. So then I like to finish with an exercise that really provides a good stretch. Almost maybe an exaggerated range of motion, something that really puts the muscle belly in a good stretch. And there's some really cool scientific stuff that talks about how muscles not only grow cross-sectionally, but lengthwise too now near the insertions and things like that. I just always felt intuitively it made sense to put an exercise like that there as opposed to early in a workout. I can't imagine doing a heavy dumbbell fly as your first chest exercise.
That wouldn't
make a lot of sense to me, but it does make a lot of sense to me to do something like that. And Scott told me something years ago I never forgot. He said, you know, there's even an element of ischemia to that, almost like blood flow restriction. You have so much blood buildup and so much of a pump, you can actually cause some compression on the veins, right? And even create some blood flow restriction to a degree, which I thought was really cool too. So, and I think there's even a little bit of probably better recovery you get from it, just elongating the muscle into a full range of motion as well. Although full range of motion exercises tend to be a little more, they tend to create more muscle damage themselves when you do them heavy, like a stiff legged deadlift. You do that heavy with a real long range of motion, your hamstrings are going to get really sore.
But I just think in general,
just generally speaking, stretching the muscle out is good for recovery. That's kind of the foundation of how the workouts are set up. And then you kind of go into the whole thing about how often do you do the body part and how hard are the sets and all that stuff. But that's kind of the, like the nucleus of how I think when it comes to training.
Right on. Now you had mentioned that this all came together based off of mistakes. Can you talk about some of those mistakes? What were mistakes that you had seen yourself make that kind of made you decide, hey, maybe I should do it this way. Maybe I should evolve a little bit. Because I know one of the things I've heard you talk about is that you don't rush right into that, like that second exercise, that meat and potato stuff. You don't rush right into that because you're not going to be as warmed up as you would have had you done the system the way you just explained it. I know that's one of them. Have there been injuries in the past that had made you go to this route?
Well, so a couple things. There was one moment I can remember. I was training at World Gym East, and I remember every Monday and Friday I would bench press first.
Okay.
And I would typically go up to 365 for a set of five or six. that was about the peak of my strength. I never really got any stronger than that. On incline I did, but not on flat bench. But there was one workout when I pulled my left pec. There's still a little dent there. If I don't tell you, you'll never see it, but there is actually a tiny dent there. Is when I was in my 20s, and it hurt really bad. The next day was black and blue. And I had had probably 20 strains up to that point. That wasn't the first time I had a near pec tear. Every single time that happened, it was from a barbell press, when I started with a barbell press. And after probably 20 near pec tears, I said, you know what? Maybe this isn't the best idea for me.
Right?
So the interesting thing was I moved the barbell presses to second in the routine.
Okay.
So I get to the barbell press. I'm not nearly as strong.
Right.
But something interesting happened. My chest actually started growing. Oh, that's interesting, right? And then my injuries went away. So I was using less weight. And everybody's like, well, it's less weight. You can't be growing. It's just fatigue. You're just a little tired. You're not weaker. It's like saying if I go out and I run around the block, run a mile, then I squat. And if I'm squatting less, I'm weaker. No, I'm not. I'm just tired. I didn't lose all my muscle. You're just tired. So, you know, there's a big part of me that thinks this. And if I publish this, everybody's going to laugh at me. But there's a big part of my heart that says it literally doesn't even matter what exercise you do as long as you go really hard with the right form.
Yeah.
And maybe you use a couple different angles because
– I'll co-author with you. We'll publish that shit.
I really think that. Like everybody says, you have to do the same exercise over and over and over. And what I found with that is you get more – inflammation, you get more tendonitis from the same movement patterns.
Yeah.
And I hear all these guys saying, well, you if you change them, change exercises, you got to relearn the motor pattern. No, you don't. Not if you're experienced. I can go in and squat right now. And I guarantee you I know how to squat and I'll feel it. Yeah. I'm not going to have to squat for 6 weeks to relearn motor patterns. Right. And the guys preaching this, they have all their guys loaded up on drugs. So of course it works. But when you actually have to think, I mean, maybe Scott and I should write, something about this. When you just think about a muscle, you're just trying to generate a lot of tension and you're trying to drive it to a fatigued state. I mean, it doesn't matter what exercise, as long as you have that mind muscle connection, you've got the proper load, you know, so people would say to me, well, how do you know if you're really getting stronger if you're doing that exercise second? But you can still measure it. You can still say, I'm still going to try to get more reps, but here's a better question. If I'm going to, let's say the target is 8 reps, and I tell you, okay, Scott, I want you to get the most weight you can for 8 reps. And if that's your target, and let's say you get to 250 and you barely get your 8th rep and you rack it, what was wrong with that? What could you have done better? Just because you write it down, it makes it better? You know? And then the next week, I'm going to tell you, maybe I'll change it to 6 reps. But let's say I say 8 reps again. I want you to get as many reps, or I want you to use as much weight as you can for 8 reps.
Yeah.
Now, let's say you get 260 and you get it for 8.
Okay.
Is that good? Absolutely, it's good. You just got a little stronger. But what if you get 240 for 8 and you barely get the 8th rep? Was it bad? I would still say no, because you're pushing the muscle. Maybe you need to change your diet. Maybe the first exercise you did, you just got a little more tired. Maybe there's some fatigue involved. So I really, really think a lot of this boils down to the key set. That one key set on each exercise where you simply just push and you get as many good reps as you can. I really think that. I really think we make this stuff, you know, we got to build it all up. But I really think if you took somebody who's experienced and you rotated their exercises, now I know everybody will blast me when I hear this, and I'm okay with that. I'm old enough to not care. But I really truly think if you took somebody and you rotated their exercises every single day, as long as they put in the right intensity, I would tell you they'll still do great.
What do you mean by the right intensity? You're talking about, so no matter what.
How close you are to failure.
Yeah, so no matter what, if it's 260, if it's 250, if it's 240, as long as I'm doing as much as I can for, in that case, that situation, 8 reps is what you're saying.
And the other thing I would say is this. Using exercises that feel right for you. So there may be exercises that Scott and I love, but maybe you don't like them. Or maybe there's something we don't particularly like, but maybe you like them. So I would say that as well. When you find those exercises that you really like, work those, is what really makes the difference. And when I say intensity, so there's, you know, this big debate, you know, oh, but you got to leave 3 or 4 reps in a tank. That's great for when you're warming up. But in my opinion, especially when you're preaching progressive resistance and you're preaching setting PRs, you mean to tell me if your training plan is leaving 3 to 4 reps in a tank, you're going to really maximize that?
Yeah.
No way. No way. Yeah. I just can't see that. So one of the ways that I have changed over the years was, and Scott and I did this the last time we trained together. So when you start your workout, the first exercise, man, it takes us a lot of warm-ups. So, I mean,
I'm there too.
It's a lot. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then when you get to the second exercise, now you don't need as many. Sure. So, you know, whereas before, let's say I do a dumbbell press, you know, and I literally might do 6, 7 warm-up sets on the dumbbell press. Mm. Then let's say you go to an incline barbell press for chest. I used to do, okay, if my target is 8 reps, okay, I'll do 140 for 8, 190 for 8, 225 for 8. I used to do that back in the old days. And it's just a waste. It's just a waste. So what I might do now is maybe 140 for 3.
Yeah.
Maybe 190 for 3. Maybe 225 for 2. And then once I get to the weight where, okay, now I'm in the ballpark. And then you just kind of go from there. You know, now, okay, I think I'm somewhere around this amount of weight for 8. If you get 8 and you have more reps in a tank, what do you think you do? You go up. Mm-hmm. It's a built-in logbook. That's the nice thing about when you have that target rep range. The logbook is built in because you want the 8th rep to be the last rep in this case. To be the last rep you can get with good form. Hmm. If you can get that 8th rep and you go, man, I know I had 2 more reps, add 5 pounds, add 10 pounds, right? It's a built-in logbook. You know, you're always, so the key is, do you execute though? Do you actually do that? That's the key. And then, so then the third exercise, now you've done 2 exercises. So now let's say Scott and I are going to do a cluster set on something. Let's say we're going to do it on a hack squat. It's our third exercise for legs. Do you think we're going to do 1 plate, 2 plates, 3 plates, 4 plates? No. We'll probably put 2 plates on there and do 6 or 7 reps, and then we'll put our working weight on there and we'll do our cluster set. So the deeper you get into the workout, you know, the warm-ups. So what you have essentially is, it's what you would call a low-volume program. I don't call anything high or low volume because I just, those discussions are just completely nonsensical. I just count our good sets. So like if Scott and I train together, we're probably going to do what you would call 4 to 6 sets.
Okay.
Somebody else might call that 12 sets.
Yeah.
It's just semantics. You see Dorian Yates train, and I've talked to him about this. And I even said, Dorian, people actually think you went to train your back and you put 315 on the bar and you did your supinated rows with it. And he just laughed. No, I did 1 plate. I did 2 plates. He just didn't count them.
Mm.
So what did Ronnie Coleman do? He did the same thing. He didn't just walk into the gym and put 8 plates on the T-bar.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I would hope that none of us are so dumb. We think we can just walk into the gym and load the weight up and do one set that way. We all have to warm up. Some of us need a little bit more than others.
Hmm.
So, you know, just warm up intelligently and don't fatigue yourself, but then go hard, right? Then go hard on that work set.
Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends, and they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com, and use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows.
I want to throw a couple of things in here. One of the things people think about when they get to what would be the second exercise in a mountain dog training workout is this is the one where you have to use the heaviest weight possible. And if you're pre-fatigued, then you can't do that. That's why people want to bench first so they can bench the heaviest weight possible. But we know from the science now, we know you can do literally sets of 20 to 30 reps if you take them to failure, if you take them to a maximal effort. would be a very light load, 30, 40, 50% of one rep max, and you can get tremendous growth with an 80% of one rep max. It's the load is important, obviously, but it's the effort that seems to be the most important. And a lot of that research is with untrained people in large part. A lot of that hasn't been done, but I know you've done high rep stuff. I've done high rep stuff. You can grow from high rep sets without a doubt. So if you've gone from, let's say, instead of using 260 on that bench to using 240, that's a very, very small loss of tension. And we can't say, there's no science that says, in fact, the science I just mentioned says there really isn't anything distinguishing that those two different loads in terms of the stimulus you get. What's most important is how hard you train with those loads, how intense the effort is, so to speak, with those loads. And it's funny, there was a study that just literally just came out, is on Brad Schoenfeld's Instagram in the last week. And it's an interesting thing because it's one of those ones that people can, it's funny that you mentioned what you said about just going in and just doing, like, picking any exercise as long as you train hard, but with the caveat that those are the right exercises for you. And in this particular study, they had one group that sort of stuck with the same exercises, used progressive overload. And the other group, I got the study, I downloaded the study, and it was like just completely random. Like everything, it was like, I think it was drawn out of a hat. They had a random number generator or something like that. And they didn't show the same progress. They didn't show the same gains from the completely random exercise selection. And that is it's a proof of concept scientifically that you just can't be completely random. But I would bet if they'd asked those people, so would you rather use this hack squat that makes you feel like your kneecaps are going to shoot across the room, or this leg press that has a really nice groove that you can really drive with? I'll go with the leg press. Okay, good. Now the next one, I'm going to give you three choices. You like this knee extension that has a nice loading curve and get you good deep knee flexion at the beginning that feels great at the top and the bottom? Or do you want to use, you know, this sissy squat that just feels like it's just awful? You can't get your balance and it's terrible. Obviously, you have to be smart, but variety can, as long as you're training hard, it's one of the basic training principles. So that study literally just came out as an interesting one. But but the flaw, so to speak, in terms of practical application is that it was just random. They just said, they picked all these random exercises. I wish I could have seen some of those workouts. Probably would have been just absolutely like, what do you want me to do? This is just asinine. So anyway.
No, that's the thing. That's right. It's got to be the right exercises. And now people are going to take that study, because I've seen it too.
Yeah,
and
right.
Now people are going to take that study and go, oh, see, you got to do the same stuff over and over, because they're not asking the next level question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that I think is kind of what you have in your program, and I do with Fortitude Training, is you go in the gym and you pick the exercise that feels right, given like, okay, that one's, my joints aren't going to handle that, or last time I trained chest, I really bombed my lower pecs. I think I'm going to do some upper pec work this time. I'm not going to do declines every single time. You shift the load based on how you feel on that day in the workout. That's okay to do. There's nothing wrong with that, as long as you're still training hard. So anyway, those are some awesome points. And I thought of that study. I'm like, that's the one that people are going to run with. You can see it happening already. Yeah.
So I think a big topic that we see nowadays is frequency. How do you figure that out? You know, you're showing us now. So, you know, we get into the gym. First, we get that mind-muscle connection going. We move into that high intensity. You know, we finish with an exercise that's going to have a stretch component in it. I go home, I'm sore. How often should somebody be training that muscle group again? And how do you figure that out?
Well, you train again when it's recovered. That's when you train it again. If it's not recovered, you don't train it. If it's recovered, you don't wait another 5 days to train it. Like, you train it when it's recovered. So then the question is, what does it mean to be recovered? Of course, it means to not be sore and to feel good. But then you also, the other component you have to look at is, it depends on the type of workout you're going to do. So if you're recovered, like say it's chest, and it's been, say you did your chest on Monday, and say Thursday you feel pretty good. Like, okay, I'm not sore, I feel good. You do have to have some intelligence with your exercise selection, though, because if you go in, like, let's say you did some real heavy barbell work on Monday, it might not be a good idea to do the real heavy barbell work again on Thursday. Your muscles might feel recovered, but your connective tissue is a little tricky. So if you are waiting, if you tend to wait longer, I tend to be a little bit more okay with more of the basic stuff. But if you tend to be training with more frequency, I would advise people to be very careful. Like, don't be benching 3 times a week. Don't be squatting 3 times a week. Now, if you want to do it light, that's fine. If that's pretty much all you're doing, that's fine.
Yeah.
But if you're going to do leg curls, leg extensions, hack squats, and squats 3 times a week, then that better be – I don't know how you do that with crazy high intensity unless you manage the volume. But so you train when you're recovered, first of all. That's number one. There's no way around that. You train when you're recovered. And then just be careful. You know, just be careful with your exercises on your connective tissue. I think if you do that, you're on the right path. The benefit with training more frequency is you stimulate the muscle more often.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. But some people go, okay, well, I'll just stimulate it Monday, Thursday, Saturday. Well, it's not recovered yet, dude. You're telling me your legs are sore and you're going in to squat.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what happens when you train a muscle when the fibers are all torn up? They don't produce as much force. They can lead to overtraining.
Hmm.
That's actually a big driver of overtraining, is training muscles when they're not recovered.
Hmm.
So, and now if you want to make it even more tricky, most people have body parts that get more sore than others. Like some people, their legs get more sore than, say, their shoulders.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So now you got a whole nother element to your programming. Well, I'm recovered. Every body part's recovered. Now what do I do? Which one do I train? In which case I would say train what you think needs the most work. Or it could be, you know what, I can't do a normal split because it's taken my legs so much longer to recover.
Hmm.
So maybe I can train my shoulders with only 2 days rest, my 48 hours, but I can't do that on legs. Hmm. So now you got to get a little bit more creative with your programming, because, again, the number one thing is recovery. And if there's different recovery rates among your body parts, you've got to kind of alter how you're doing it. And to be 100% honest with you, my training split is – what is the least sore? I'm only going to train something that's not sore and it feels good.
Hmm.
Whatever is right there when I wake up.
I'm no kidding. Okay.
So I went into the gym today. My legs are the least sore. They're not sore at all. They feel good. If they were sore, I wouldn't have trained them. So I did legs.
Hmm.
Now, if nothing's sore, my recovery's off the charts, then what I do, my next question is I ask, what do I need to work on the most?
Okay.
So I'll prioritize that ahead of something that maybe doesn't need as much work.
Hmm.
Right? So I literally train what I feel is ready to train the most. And if it's the answer to that is multiple body parts, then I'm going to train what I think I need the most help with.
So what you're talking about, this is not something you're saying is on paper. This is an intuitive method that you're looking at.
Very intuitive, yeah. Yeah, I mean, eventually I'll put something like that on paper, but it's really, you know, like Scott and I, man, we've trained for decades. And it's hard to give somebody who's been training for 2 years a program like that. A lot of times you're just going to confuse them.
Hmm.
Like, well, I don't know if this is too sore or if this is not sore enough but I really do feel like eventually everybody should get to the point where this is all intuitive.
Hmm. Hmm.
Eventually it should get to the point where it's all intuitive.
That's what I get from you too, man. Like with your training and the, you know, I watch your YouTube and I even before you were doing all the videos you do nowadays, you've always had a lot of creativity in the gym. You're coming up with ideas of your own. Can you talk about that? Because I feel like we can get so stuck on following something that's written in front of us, and to come up with some of the ideas you've had, you couldn't have been, you know, you just had to have loved it. You had to have been playing. You had to have been figuring out what worked for you.
Well, you know, when I was in college and high school, I was sitting there writing down workout routines during the lectures. And the teachers were like, oh, John, he's so diligent. He's taking notes. Like, no, not really. I've always been obsessed by it. And I was training over at Gold's in 1999. And I remember Jim Seitzer coming in. Jim is a former Mr. America, and he actually worked with Mike Francois many, many years ago, back in Greg Greenzales' day. You probably don't know all these old guys, but Jimmy watched me train for a couple months, and he goes, I've never seen somebody that's creative as you. Like, you can literally,
no kidding,
every problem you have, you think about how to solve it instead of just doing, let me turn this off. He said, you're the most, and he was working with Mike. He hadn't worked with Mike, and he said, man, if Mike would have been that creative,
huh,
you know, I think we could have made him Mr. Olympia. But to me, my end result is what I wanted. So if I had to change what I was doing, I was okay with that. So like, I liked the bench press first. I enjoyed that, but I realized it wasn't a good idea for me. So the question is, okay, what do I do?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's how it's always been to me. You know, I've come up with a lot of exercises over the years that I think a lot of people do. I get tagged in probably 5-10 different exercises every day. I learned this from John, and they're little different variations, you know, the partial side laterals or the all the different rowing movements we do, and, you know, a lot of the unique stuff we do. That stuff was created to solve a problem. You know, if things were going well for me, then I wouldn't need to change anything or do anything special. But my back, for example, was horribly underdeveloped. It was terrible. I was doing tons of chins, bent over rows, and deadlifts. That's a recipe for mass, right? That's how you get a big back.
Sure.
Well, it didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. You know, it gave me great traps, great spinal erectors, and good biceps. So, you know, I mean, I fully understand lightening the weight and really feeling it. But by the time I felt it the way I wanted to feel it, I had 140 pounds on the barbell doing a row. So I never really, those things didn't really work the way I wanted them to work. So I'm like, let me try this. Oh, that one I really felt, like the one-arm barbell row. I was at a California Fitness, right? The commercial of all commercial gyms. I don't even know if they're still around now. I think they might be called something else. I just bent down and said, there's a little, like, it's forcing me to be at an angle. Let me try that, because the dumbbells swing. Let me just try that. It's like, oh, wow, man, I really felt that in my lower lat. That feels really good.
Huh.
And that's how it was with a lot of these exercises. And there's a lot of them I've done that I didn't do. I thought, well, that was stupid. Why did I try that?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't write about those.
Yeah. Those don't get filmed. Those will get on YouTube.
Yeah, nobody knows about all the dumb things I've done. So
I've got a lot of those, too, that I never published, so to speak.
But you are the master of using the leg curl machine.
Yes.
So that's kind of how it was, Scott. It's just, you know, I had to solve problems. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I have bad genetics, but I also would tell you I don't have Flex Wheeler genetics either. You know, I had to put a lot of thought into solving problems and doing things a little differently. And I was very fortunate, too. I was also around people that really pushed me to train hard. There were two guys. My very first coach, Mike Mattson, was incredibly intense. And his message to me was always intensity over everything, man. And great coach. Still, we're great friends to this day. And then when I moved to Columbus to train, and, you know, there was guys at the gym, all the big champions that trained at World Gym East, which was the legend gym here. Man, those guys took me under their wing. Those were the guys that taught me how to do sets of 60 on those partial side laterals and a lot of the crazy stuff I do. I learned it from them.
Sets
they were
of
like,
60,
let's do.
Huh?
Well, we would do 60 reps on bent over, you know, the exercise that nobody thinks works anymore, a rear dumbbell fly, right?
Yeah,
your rear
delts.
Yeah, all of a sudden they don't work your rear delts. And then the heavy side laterals, everybody, you know, people now see them, they go, you're not using a full range of motion. That's useless. Okay, just try it. Just grab a heavy pair of dumbbells and just swing them out a quarter of the way and just do 25, 30 reps like that. Tell me how you feel. I've never felt my shoulders like that in my life. Okay, maybe you stimulated something, right? So just little things like that. So I thought that way. Plus, I was exposed to creative people. Anytime somebody has showed me something, I've always tried to give them credit for it, for teaching me. And I'm still like that now. I'm still, you know, trying to figure things out, man. I'll be doing that for many, 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 many more years.
Yeah, that is a unique aspect of something I've always seen, whether it be through watching your videos or, you know, having followed your stuff, through the years. I guess what I'm thinking too is I feel like one of the things I think I see people doing nowadays, and it's easy to get caught up into. I feel almost it's like it's easy to feel paralyzed by thinking yourself out of something. You know, like you said, you know, that dumbbell lateral raise, it's not supposed to work like this. It's not that doesn't sound right. You know, I've heard people tell me the opposite, that you need to. It's the top range. That's where you need to be. That's where the actual shoulder's getting activated.
Well, yeah.
So it's like I feel like there's so much knowledge out there that it could almost shut you down from trying something like that.
Right now, one of the things that drives me crazy is we are 100% locked into strength curves. You know, Scott, Dave, Tate, and I have been talking about strength curves for 10 plus years. but it doesn't mean every single exercise you do has to be a perfect strength curve. Sometimes it's good to have to fight through a rep and dig down deep and fight through it, not have a perfect strength curve. That's good sometimes. And it's a different kind of stimulation. But to your point, when you're talking about shoulders, you know, well, you know, when you're up here, hey, listen, I love doing that stuff, but it doesn't mean every single exercise you do should be that way. And I find that a lot of people preaching this stuff, they really should put on a lot more muscle before they become experts. You know, you see guys talking about shoulders and arms and legs, and like, dude, you don't even have any arms. You don't even have any legs. Like, I mean, I'm not trying to dismiss the analytical component to it.
No, of course not.
But I would just, like, if you're going to, you know, I can sit down and have a conversation with you about how I built my arms. My arms sucked for many years. And I put 2 inches on them when I figured out a lot of things with arms over the course of 2 years. So I had to figure something out. And, you know, I looked at guys like Rich Gaspari. Rich Gaspari, I mean, he didn't have, like, over-the-top Lee Haney or Flex Wheeler genetics. I respected him. He did a lot with what he had.
Yeah.
Tom Platz, of course, he had ridiculous leg genetics, but look at the intensity he brought.
Oh, yeah.
Like, look at the thing, like those are the guys that I looked at. When I tried the stuff that Lee Haney was doing, and by the way, Lee Haney is like one of my favorite people in the world. But when I tried the stuff that a lot of these genetically gifted guys do, it didn't work for me. So I looked at guys like Tom Platz and Gaspari, and what are those guys doing?
Yeah.
And you know what you'll find with those guys? They were training very intensely. When you and listen, I followed their training all since the 80s. So I'm watching these guys train in the 80s because we had ESPN back then. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and I was reading all their articles and magazines, but those guys trained hard. I mean, they trained really, really hard. The guys that I wanted to emulate, they trained really hard. So anyways, I know I'm off on a tangent, but.
No, this is important, John. Like, if you think about this, like, just to connect some things that as you're talking, if like, there's so many things that can make muscle grow. I mean, I posted something about compensatory hypertrophy in an animal model. It produces tremendous growth, and it can actually happen in people too. You can look at like wrench monkeys, mechanics who spend all day, you know, doing that, and their forearms are gigantic. You know, Dave Henry, when he's a drummer, when he plays a lot, because he's always working the bass with his foot, his tibialis anterior is gigantic. You can see that on stage. There's so many different things that are outside the box. So how, if you're trying to figure out, you know, working with volume landmarks and your number of sets, and you're like picking apart the numbers to fit it into the traditionally accepted or nowadays accepted box of how you piece together a program, well, what do you do with the 60 rep set? You know, what do you do when you want to put 2 1/4 on the squat bar and set the kitchen timer for 10 minutes and get as many reps as you can? Like, how does that fit? Like, those are the outside-of-the-box things that seem to distinguish the people who, like you said, like Gaspari and Plass, people who have just, despite their genetics, have pushed maximal muscle growth. And they're doing things like all the things like the intensification techniques, drop sets, even cluster sets. Like, how do those can't even be like – those aren't even a known factor in the equation of sets times reps times load that most people use. Like, that's so simplistic. It's kind of like – like, I'm busy outside playing with my RV, like, trying to wire stuff up and, like, trying not to get killed in the process, you know, I know what positive and negative is and when not to touch live wires, but there's capacitors and resistors, and I've been playing with relays. There's so much complexity to this, so using just sets and reps, and even reps in reserve is a phenomenal factor to consider, but even just using those, that's really, like, that's loading 101 in the context of all the things that can come into play. And then when you've been doing it, like you said, for decades, to some point in time, you literally, it's sort of an art form of intuition where you figure out, it's like, okay, today we can do a challenge set. Today we're going to, like, just like we did when training at the Elite FTS compound with Dave way back when, and we did that deadlift. I think it was the PhD versus Meathead thing. You know, that was a blast. And we didn't know what we were going to do. Dave just started throwing chains on the bar, and we just kept on going until we got to something that felt like it was going to be heavy as hell. And we went to town. It was a blast. And doing that outside the box, like, extreme efforts that create that, it actually even goes back to general adaptation syndrome, if you want to use that as your sort of your standard for modeling this. That's a novel new stimulus. And those things, like 60 rep set of side laterals where you're just grinding and grinding, or you know, some of the crazy things that you've done in the gym that have been filmed, those things are tremendous stimuli. And you can't, those have to be, those are a vital, that's like the salt in your soup. Otherwise, everything's so bland. And I think that's what can make for a really nice recipe for hypertrophy that people just don't, they don't get sometimes if they just sort of stick into the X's and O's and the black and white of sets, reps, and rest and reserve, et cetera, that is becoming a pretty common way to kind of argue what is the right way to train. So.
Well, and I think, too, I've always had this element is of fun. Like, I really want to have fun when I train.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this for a lot of years. And I'm sorry, but doing the exact same routine. You know, I hear people say Dorian did the same routine for 10 years or whatever. Hey, that's great for Dorian, but that's not for John Meadows, right? I don't want to do the same routine my whole life. Like, I like to have fun. I like to push myself in different ways, to Scott's point. I just I think there's an element to just having fun and having a good time. And I have a lot of fun when I push myself to a certain point of, you know, pain, good pain or whatever. There could be something I do that's like, man, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Really challenge now, yourself.
I mean, yeah. So, there's no better feeling than walking out of the gym and saying, that's it, man. Like, I did it. Like, there's nothing more I could have done, you know? But, and listen, it's not for beginners. I'm not sitting here saying when you start training your first couple of years, all this stuff I'm training is as you get older, you get more advanced. I'm not saying that everybody in there, when they start working out, should rotate exercises, should do challenge sets, should do drop. I'm not saying that. Hopefully people can distinguish what I'm saying. But as you get 10 years into it, 15 years, 20 years into it, then those things I think can really make a big difference. And, you know, I've been around a long time and I've seen a lot of people just quit. They don't train anymore. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Their interests change. That's understandable. But I think a lot of them would probably still be training if they just had fun. Mm-hmm. But they look at it as like, oh, I got to go train. And then eventually they're like, I don't want to train anymore. I look at it most of the time, not all the time, but I look at it. It's like, I can't wait to get in there and train today. I'm going to have fun. You know, it's a different mindset. Not always, not every day.
Yeah.
You know, but I think there's an element of having fun too, man.
Yeah, I see that. And that's what I was getting at, I guess, too, with your creativity. I can't imagine you coming up with the things you come up with if you weren't having fun with it. And you know, further too, I thought you'd appreciate this. I don't know if you've heard this. Tom Platt said he didn't even remember saying it. He looked at me kind of funny when I mentioned it to him. But I got a chance to meet him a couple of years ago at the Olympia. In one of his old videos, it's floating around on YouTube somewhere, he said, we are artists and we express ourselves through our sets and our reps.
Yeah, he says it all
the time. Yeah, I'll tell you, that reminds me a lot of where you're coming from, too. Who was somebody that was so like super inspirational, super exciting that you trained with, you know, since you became the Mountain Dog? Because you have access now. You have trained with Tom Platz, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've trained with him, and you know, we talked about, you know, you guys mentioned training over at Elite with Dave Tate. Man, I've seen some of those sets. Some of those sets that I've seen Dave Tate do, and a particular leg workout that you guys did, there was a squat superset with a belt squat. And I don't even know how many minutes this went on, but like it's burned in my brain as this thing that like I feel like I can think of that no matter what I'm doing. I'm like, man, I can do this. If that human being could do that, I can do what I'm about to do. You know, it's like it's just burned in my head some of that stuff. Can you talk about an experience like that?
Well, so a little bit of the Elite stuff. So I was when I trained with Dave, I think that people observing what we would do, I think if most people listening to this or watching this, for example, I think if they saw what we were doing, they would probably all be in agreement that we were doing too much. Now, but I'll say this.
Yeah.
When I was training with Dave, I made phenomenal progress. And we typically train legs on Saturday. Then it turned into back. But my legs got well over 30 inches. They grew a lot training there. Mm. And I made tremendous improvements in my back. In fact, I'd love to send you some pictures of after I trained there for a couple of years. I had made tremendous progress. And it kind of made me rethink what we're capable of. Like a lot of the stuff, and Scott trained there, he knows, a lot of stuff we did, like the very first set of Bulgarian, the drop set of death. You know who did that? It was me and Scott.
No kidding. You know You're
that,
kidding me.
You know how that came up? That's famous now. I get tagged on it 50 times a day.
Yeah.
Do you know how that came about?
No.
I was sitting there at Lead FTS looking at Scott, and I was thinking to myself, what can we do to really F ourselves up? Yeah. Like, that's the origin of it.
So you weren't even thinking like, what could we do to get the biggest today, Scott? That wasn't on your mind. You're like, what's the biggest challenge?
Let's get our so much blood in our legs. It feels like the skin's going to rip off. Let's see how much pain we can take.
Yes.
And the result of doing that was incredible. Like, I've never felt that before. That like that level of pain was on another level.
Yeah.
That was on another level. And that was just literally just sitting there thinking, man, that's a painful thing once you get up to a lot of reps. What if you found a way to keep going? And then what if you held it there and did the isopole too?
Yeah.
Let's just do it all. Right.
Right. So, that day, John, I think we did some sort of a crazy hamstring glute bridge type of thing.
One leg at a time. Yeah.
I mean, it was like 5 minutes a person to go through that. And then I know we did the Romanian split squats as well, and there might have been something in between there. And I think we also went and got on the hack squat and did like a Widowmaker type set too.
Oh, yeah.
At the end. Yeah. So it was like those three things would have been like considered challenge sets for lots of people, especially the second two, the latter two, the Bulgarian and the Widowmaker. And there was more to it. Did we do some reverse hypers or two, something?
Oh, man. It was endless. I remember, I don't coach people to do this anymore, but I remember doing drop sets on the squat itself and then going over to the leg press and doing an ascending set. So that's when you put on some weight, do some reps, put on some weight. You do it nonstop until you get up to as much weight as you can.
Yeah.
And, well, we got all this weight on here. Now we got to do a drop set to come down. And then, well, it's right beside the hack squat, so we might as well do the hack squat. And then it's, well, we really haven't done any knee extension. We might as well do some drop sets on the leg extensions. Well, we really haven't done any lunges. I mean, that's what it turned into. And every exercise had a brutal inset to it. And again, most people would say that's overtraining. And for most people, it might be.
Yeah.
It probably would be. But for me, it was what I needed. And I do think people don't give themselves enough credit, providing their nutrition is good, their rest, all that stuff, right? I don't think people give themselves enough credit or push themselves enough. I don't think they even know where the limit is. Mm. You know, I use this phrase all the time. You never know where the line is until you cross it a little.
Yeah.
And I don't think people, like, how are you going to know where the line is when you're preaching, when you're doing three or four sets in reserve every set? You don't even know. In fact, I would tell you what you think is three or four reps in reserve might be seven or eight reps in reserve. Because it's hard when you're at the three, four, five. It's hard to know exactly how many reps you have in reserve.
Yeah.
As you get closer to failure, you know, okay, I probably got one more or maybe two more. But when you start doing three, four, five, six sets and reps in reserve, man, it might be 10.
Yeah.
There's so many sets I guarantee you Scott and I have done where we thought, man, there's probably two reps left in reserve. You know what? We got six more.
Mm.
Just from the mental push.
Mm.
And I just don't think people understand the value of doing that push intelligently and not hurting yourself.
That's documented in the science, too. Like Eric Helms, who kind of like brought this reps and reserve notion into the literature and now into notoriety, like that they've done that with people where they say, oh, so what's your reps and reserve? And someone says three. And like there are people who are like, we're getting 12, 15 more.
Yeah,
so those are untrained individuals too. So you get better at estimating that the more experienced you are. But that's absolutely true, and it reminds me we keep on bringing up Tom Platz. Like his thing is five. Give me five more.
Yeah.
Like you go into your training, he's like, give me five more, and he'll give you three of those. So you get 15 more reps.
Yeah.
And you do that partly because it's Tom Platz in front of you, but there's so many things like you said that are deep within us that we're capable of, but it's just the motivation. You know, having enough screws loose to like tap into that and really want to make it happen is what matters. So
I like that.
And I think the guys who aren't, you know, at the top of the genetic food chain, I think this is even more important for them. Mm. You know, if you want to get close to your genetic ceiling, then I think this becomes very important.
So, John, I have a question back to the notion of frequency and volume. Everyone seems to be talking now about, you know, using volume as a main way to sort of drive muscle growth, trying to train with as much volume as possible. And the thing that you're going to run up against if you train hard, of course you've been training for years, is that your volume is going to be limited by the simple fact that you're training so hard that you can't do a ton of sets with that kind of volume. And so I'd be interested in just your thoughts on that, just in general, and then specifically on this solution, which I think is a good one, especially for someone who wants to do like a, say, a push-pull leg split, and they find that their upper body recovers more quickly, or some muscle of their body recovers more quickly than the legs, simply adjusting the volume down in the legs, and so the volume is less, the frequency stays the same. You can train with a lower frequency to adjust the total volume over a long period of time, or simply train with a lower volume at a certain frequency, and it does the same thing all in all.
So. Yeah, you can. Yeah, 100%. So you can manipulate it. If your legs are sore for 5 days, you might say, okay, well, that third exercise, maybe I'll cut it out, or maybe I won't do a cluster set on that third exercise. You know, that, right. To allow yourself. I don't like to be crazy sore. Like last 2 weeks ago, I got a sports hernia right now. So a lunge is very painful for me, but I'm to the point now where I can actually do a body weight lunge. So I did this body weight lunge just 2 weeks ago, and I hadn't done them for a long time. So I was crazy sore, like old school sore. I hate that. I can't stand that. Like, you don't need to be that sore.
Old school sore. Anyway,
dive on the toilet when you go to the bathroom type sore.
Oh my God, it was bad. From body weight lunges. But you know, so you can adjust. That certainly works. You know, tailor again. That goes back to being intuitive to tailoring the amount of volume for a body part to allow it to recover. I do like the working up to a hard set, but honestly, there are times too when I just feel like, you know what, I need to ease back a little bit. Like I don't have it in me today to do a cluster set. If I find myself getting to that level, then I'll do more sets because I know I'm not going as hard. So now I can do more sets. But again, it's not just random. It's for a reason. I'm not doing a ton of sets because I'm under the belief that a ton of sets are better. I'm under the belief that it's the best way for me to train right now in my current state.
Right.
You know, so I think a lot of approaches can work. And I think, I don't necessarily think you should get tied to one particular approach. Sometimes it's just fun to just do a lot more. Sometimes I don't want to kill myself.
Right.
You know, sometimes I just don't, honestly. Sometimes I just don't want to kill myself. So instead of doing 4 really hard sets, I might do 12 sets where I do leave some reps in the tank. Get a good pump. I feel good. I leave the gym. I got something accomplished. So I do think that people are on this hunt to find the perfect volume when there is no perfect volume. You have a perfect volume for in the state you're in now, maybe, but that could change in a week. It could change in 2 weeks. You may find some kind of motivation that hits you where all of a sudden now you want to go hard. Like, I'll give you an example of that. So every year when I competed, I would, after the show was over, I would train for a couple weeks. I wouldn't go real hard because I had no desire to go to failure after a show. I personally believe that if you were killing yourself leading up to a show, after the show, you probably won't have that desire if you were really training hard. Then I would take a little break, and then I would start training back easy. And I would just keep training easy. And I didn't put any pressure on myself. And every single year, I could be driving to the gym. I could be listening to a song. I could be watching a movie. And something would click. And it was like, okay, it's time to go now. And when that clicked, I would go, bam. I'd go back in the gym and I'd start killing myself. But I never forced it.
Yeah.
I always let it come to me. And it always did. It always did. And honestly, the first year it didn't come to me was 2018. And you saw I didn't compete in 2018.
Yeah.
It just didn't come back to me until like late in the year. And this year it's been good. I have that. But I did that. I used to just – and my point in telling you the story is just that – there's times when you're going to turn it on and you're going to do awesome. And then there, my battery's running a little bit low here. I got some time left.
All right.
So there's times when you're going to not feel like going nuts. That's okay. Just get in there and do some work. That's okay. And then there's times when the switch is flipped, like bam, it's time to go. And when that switch flips, man, take advantage of it. Push yourself as hard as you can push.
That's great advice. That's Scott, is there anything else that you want to ask John? Anything that you feel that we should cover with him before we go?
Well, the thought I had when John was talking about sort of like that's an intuitive approach too, is it's connected with this being fun. Like it should be something you want to do. So if like, let's substitute weight training for playing Monopoly. And like, you know, you don't want to play Monopoly. You don't want to play Monopoly. Like maybe you just want to play checkers or something else, but you don't have to deal with all the, you know, the different monies and all the complications. But sometimes you like really want to dig into that. You can imagine how horrible it would be to be forced to play Monopoly when you don't want to play the game. Like every second would be terrible.
Yeah.
And I think people do that sometimes with themselves. They feel like they have to force themselves to do something they don't want to do, and they take the fun out of it. And eventually that'll just sap your motivation. Those are the people who don't end up training very much or literally don't, you have to have that time when you step back after a show or whenever your motivation isn't there in order to regain the motivation that you need to actually make progress. Otherwise, it's like you're continually trying to run the car when the tank is empty, and you never give it time to fill back up, and you're never going to get to your destination. So there's a lot of wisdom, even if it means taking a month off. And of course, if you never come back, then you never come back. It wasn't meant to be. But being too OCD and like forgetting about the fun that it should be to go in the gym and train for a pump or train like a maniac is the one thing that people can kind of miss out on, because they get so obsessed with getting from point A to point B, they forget to enjoy the journey, which is about having fun while you're training, at least in my opinion. So.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. Well, let's let John get out of here. His battery's about to die. John, this is you got to understand, man. This is a huge pleasure for me. Like I said, I've been learning from you well before you knew who I was. That's for sure, man. It's been a decade plus that I've been following along with what you've been doing, and you've influenced me. You've helped me to become more creative in my training, whether it be in the way I execute other people's programs or, you know, just in the training that I put together myself day to day, man. It's so I want to say thank you. I really appreciate it.
Oh no, man. It's my pleasure. At this point in my life, you know, I'm trying to get to Maslow's hierarchy, to the top of the pyramid where it's self-actualization and that's helping others and having a good impact on others. So it makes me feel good that I've at least contributed positively in some way. So thank you.
Absolutely. And guys, of course, if you want to check out more of what John's doing, I'm sure everybody already knows, but if you don't, check out Mountain Dog One over on YouTube, Mountain Dog One on Instagram. And is it Mountain Dog Diet is your website?
Yeah. .com.
Yes. All right. Cool, guys. We'll check all that stuff out. Scott Stevenson, John Meadows, guys, this has been a hell of a pleasure. I really appreciate you both.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Stay warm, buddy.